before we go back to somebody for a second. And discretionarily, I'll allow a little bit of follow-up, but only so much. We need to kind of move on. And we do ask that you state a question and not a sermon. So it's kind of one of those things, you know it when you see it. But we'll reserve the right to enforce that rule. I feel like I'm almost overqualified to introduce our speaker tonight. I've known Robert Hunt since we were both 13 years old, growing up as teenagers on the playground in Richardson. We were college roommates for a year at the University of Texas. And so I've extracted a suitable bribe, you know, for not saying some of the things I could say. So you're okay, Robert. Deal's deal.
I'm getting the mic in a minute.
Dr. Hunt is a graduate of the Perkins School of Theology, where he now is on the faculty as the Director of Global Theological Education. In between his learning at Perkins and returning to the faculty there, he spent time in a number of exotic places, including Malaysia, and where he got a PhD from the University of Malaysia. And so has experienced a lot of different cultural expressions of religion in their native environment, and not just sort of from textbooks, but from actually seeing it. And I've told some of my stories, and some people are already remembering them, so there's only so much new material I can use. But Robert's always great to engage in any subject. We had so many contentious discussions in the room at college that we put a list on the wall of all the arguments that we had. And I didn't bring it, but actually still got that list. So without any more into his time, let's give a warm Dallas Philosophers Forum welcome to Dr. Robert Hunt.
I want to thank you all very much for the chance to come. I was asked to speak on a topic that I spoke on probably over a year ago at a gathering at North Haven United Methodist Church called The Mystery at the Heart of the Universal, and that's what I'll be speaking on again. It interests me, someone was asking me about North Haven Church the other day, and was it a representative Methodist church? I think even the members of North Haven would say it's not. That may be a good thing, though. I'm gonna do a few things that I like to do. One is I'm going to indulge myself by beginning and ending this lecture with a quote that takes place, that comes out of contemporary English fiction about talking animals. And somehow I find such fiction quite touching myself, so I hope I can make my way through it. The two pieces I'm thinking of are Kenneth Graham's The Wind and the Willows and C.S. Lewis's The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Those will be the bookends for this talk. And in the middle, I'm going to give you a history lecture, because I'm actually a historian by nature, by trade. But I hope that it's not boring, and I hope that it's actually universal and will get us into thinking a little bit about what it means to talk about what's universal and what that means in a religious context in particular, and what it means for those who are interested in big philosophical questions and in spiritual seeking and longing. At the beginning of The Wind and the Willows, Mole, who for the first time has fled the security of his underground home, meets the water rat. The water rat tells him the wonders of the river that run through Mole's meadow. And Mole then sees for the first time the woods just beyond the meadow and the river. And this conversation follows. "What lies over there?" asked the mole, waving a paw toward the background of woodland that darkly framed the water meadows at one side of the river. "Oh, that's just the wild wood," said the rat shortly. "We don't go there very much, we riverbankers." Aren't they very nice people there?" said the mole, a trifle nervously. Well, replied the rat, let me see. The squirrels are all right, and the rabbits, some of them, but rabbits are a mixed lot. And then there's Badger, of course. He lives right in the heart of it and wouldn't live anywhere else either if you paid him to do it. Dear old Badger. Nobody interferes with him, and they'd better not, he added significantly. Why, who should interfere with him? Asked the mole. Well, of course, there are others, explained the rat in a hesitating sort of way. Weasels and stoats and foxes and so on. They're all right in a way. I'm very good friends with them, pass the day with them when we meet, that sort of thing. But they break out sometimes. There's no denying it. Well, you can't really trust them. That's a fact. The mole knew well that it was quite against animal etiquette to dwell on possible trouble ahead or even to allude to it, so he dropped the subject. And beyond the wild woods again, he asked, where's all that blue and dim, and one sees what may be hills or maybe they mayn't, and something like the smoke of towns, or is it only cloud drift? Beyond the wild wood comes the wide world, said the rat, and that's something that doesn't matter either to you or me. I've never been there, I'm never going, nor are you either if you've got any sense at all. Don't ever refer to it again, please. And then, here's our backwater at last, and we're going to lunch. This evening I'm going to talk about the mystery of the universal. I'm going to talk about exactly what we confront when we get out of our religious and philosophical backwaters and look at the wide world, and then consider what that means. In particular, I'm going to ask you to consider how a change in the human situation forces people to widen their religious understanding, how universal religious claims arise, and how the idea of universality points toward mystery, and how in our own time the idea of mystery at the heart of the universal may well be critical to human well-being and flourishing. Primal religions, to get our start, primal religions in myth and ritual bring their followers into a way of seeing and relating to the world that Clifford Geertz calls something that makes their way of seeing the world uniquely realistic. That's Geertz's definition of religion. In their limited experience of the world, the people who hold primal religions find that these myths and these rituals account for everything and leave room for some new things as well. What happens when people who hold to a primal religious group belief, and let me take the Iban people of Sarawak, for example, a people who I lived with and who I studied for some time, what happens when they meet someone who has a whole different religion, who has a whole different set of myths and rituals, right? A different primal religious group. Well, normally, a lot of blending occurs. It turns out that these primal religions, in these primal religions, myth and ritual are relatively fluid. New stories and new ritual actions can be added to one's repertoire to make sense of new experience. Oftentimes, it's assumed that different mythological figures who have different names in different religious groups, are actually the same. And we see this, for example, when Greek primal religion mixes with Roman primal religion, and you come to the assumption that because gods have similar characteristics, that you've got two gods, but they're really just the same god with two different names, right? A Latin name and a Greek name. Zeus, Jupiter. Easy. It's not a problem. So religion, as primal religious groups meet other primal religious groups, and they blend their ideas and myths and rituals to account for the slightly larger world, these become more complex. But as they become more complex, they also become much more useful. They become a way of living in a wider world that remains uniquely realistic, uniquely comprehensive, and which thus continues to explain, everything in the person's or the group's experience. It justifies their actions, and it gives their lives a sense of meaning beyond their own weakness or inability or even death. So the religion remains primal, albeit more complex, but it continues to give life meaning. Now, early in the last century, that is to say, early in the 20th century, students of history, religion, and philosophy, in particular a philosopher named Carl Jaspers, coined the term axial age to refer to the period between 800 before the Common Era and 200 of the Common Era, in which simultaneously in Greek, Indian, and Chinese cultural zones there arose a new and in some ways similar ways of conceiving the universe. In particular, Jaspers was thinking of Platonism, Buddhism, and Taoism as Axial Age religions. Now later this term Axial Age religions would come to mean a little bit broader group of religious groups. But all of them belong to this particular special age from about 800 before the Christian era to 200 after the Christian era. Now what I want to say though is that this term Axial Age should be less seen as a distinctive moment in history of three great civilizations, and more as a distinctive moment that marks the change of any human society from a primal to a universal or proto-universal approach to the world. It's a change that happens to almost every society, and may have happened to many societies that we don't know about because they're lost to us in history, to both individuals and socials. In this new situation, the primal religions, with their adaptable myths and their adaptable rituals, reach the limit of their ability to make sense of human life. They just can't adapt anymore. They just can't expand anymore. And what happens then is what we call usually, the birth of what we usually call the world religions. Religions that arose because societies needed a not only quantitatively different, but a qualitatively different kind of religion to make sense of the world that they lived in. Now, the focus of the world religions that we know and that we usually name is Europe, the Middle East, and Asia, but that doesn't at all mean we might not have seen and just don't know about similar developments in Africa and Latin America. Part of the problem is where you have cultures that didn't develop literacy along with other social changes, then we don't have adequate remains, in a sense, intellectual remains, to make sense of what happened in their religious transformations. Okay? In any case, to be very honest, they're beyond my area of expertise. So forget it, they don't exist. Let's talk about what we do know, or at least what I know. Okay? In this situation, relatively small societies reach a point at which their religion can no longer accommodate the complexity of the human experience that they are accounting. The borrowed myths and rituals are too numerous, or perhaps they become simply flat contradictory. Too obviously contradictory to be acceptable. Okay? Or perhaps events are unfolding so rapidly that the religious answer to how you relate to these events doesn't work. In any case, something changes, and I want to suggest some of the reasons for those changes. One is the rise of something like what we now would call an empire. An empire happens when a single group expands to dominate its neighbors and to justify and extend that domination by imposing its own worldview on those neighbors. So it doesn't merely dominate them in the sense of taking them slave and making them agricultural slaves. It dominates them in the sense of saying, you now have to think the way we think. Right? You have to now think the way we think. Empires have arisen at many phases in history. I happen to have given a lecture not very long ago, a mere hour and a half ago, about the rise of the first empires in China, the Shang, a nearly legendary dynasty, but followed by the Chu, and then followed by the warring states there, and eventually the Han, which are an excellent example of this. Because you have a group of people, later the Han people, who conquer a wide group of aboriginal peoples that do not belong to their same culture, but upon whom they impose their worldview. And what that is going to require, if you think about this, okay, what it's going to require is an assertion of universality. In other words, to impose my worldview on someone else is to assert that my worldview is better than yours. And if I'm going to impose it on a lot of different somebody else's, I'm beginning to make the assertion that my worldview is a universal worldview. It's right for everybody, not just me. So the Shang people in China don't merely say, oh, well, we're the Shang, and this is the way we do things, and it happens that we have a military advantage over you Aboriginal groups that we've conquered. Quite to the contrary. The Shang say, we're the Shang and we have our way of doing things, and our god, Shang Ti, the original founder of the Shang dynasty, is everybody's god. Right? And what does that do for them? Well, it justifies their imposing it on everybody else, right? It explains why you ought to accept my way of doing things, because my way is universal. Yours is merely parochial. Okay? And we find this happening, by the way, in empire after empire as empires rise, is that they begin to make this essential assertion that their way of seeing the world, their worldview, their religious norms are indeed universal and therefore ought to be embraced by everybody else. The conquest of the Aryan people of the Indian subcontinent follows a very similar pattern. They conquer the Harappan people, who they do not only dominate militarily and by the way, reduce to the lowest form of their caste system, but whom they also dominate religiously and begin to assert that the Vedas, their particular religious books of ritual, are universally true. And then what follows is a period of a very enormously fruitful period of philosophical thinking and growth through the Upanishads, in which the Aryan peoples show or seek to demonstrate the universality and meaningfulness of their religious tradition, and ultimately lift to the highest possible levels what was probably originally a kind of a tribal deity, Brahman, who becomes the essence of being for the entire universe, right? Okay. The Assyrian and Babylonian conquests that sweep the Middle East, but in particular Alexander's conquest of the world, come to some much of the same thing. Such conquests are both a challenge for the conquered and a challenge for the conqueror, because the conqueror has to figure out how to make this assertion of universality. Now, I want to pause here for a second. None of these conquering people sort of sat down and go, how do I justify the fact that I'm conquering you? No, I mean, they didn't think that way. The justification for conquest back in the good old days was because I want your stuff. They weren't that self-reflective. The assumption was, if I can take it, I deserve to have it. But nonetheless, there are challenges posed over time to the inner workings and inner thinking of these conquerors and the conquered, which require an explanation for why a large group of diverse religious beliefs and attitudes and worldviews are now gathered into a single thing, a single empire. And that's what's happening. But I have to say, it is not merely the challenge of conquest. It's a challenge that is extended by the rise in this period of trade, the rise of new cosmopolitan cities, which involve people who are not only conquered, but who come beyond the conquered lands to trade in them. Right? One of the things that my students find fascinating, and the question they always ask, and it's a question that's often asked in historical circles, is why is it that so many ideas that appear in sort of proto-Hinduism about 500 before the Christian era and in the rise of Buddhism also appear in Greece, right, in the same period of time? Why is that? Well, the answer is because they traded with each other constantly. And you can see this in artwork. Right? You can see the way in which the depiction of folded robes and things like this are moving across from Greece into the subcontinent and even further into China. We had a guest lecturer, was it last week now? Yes, it seems to be last week, last Wednesday, sponsored by the Aga Khan Foundation. So here I'm going to put in a plug. The Aga Khan Foundation usually brings a couple of lecturers on art and religion to the Perkins School of Theology every year. The lectures are always free. Keep an eye out. This guy was flipping brilliant. I mean, he gave the lecture that I wish I would someday give. And he gave it on royal symbols, symbols of royalty. And two things stood out that are directly related to our subject. One is, why is it that we find depictions of the Buddha with a halo and we find depictions of Jesus Christ with a halo? Okay. Well, the answer is that the halo is a simplification and an essentialization of a sun crown with which Roman emperors were typically crowned in order to relate to the sun god and his power. On the Christian side, those sun crowns were picked up for imperial figures. Jesus is Lord, right? Okay? And the Buddha, Siddhartha, is what? A prince. But in both traditions, it came to mean holiness as well. But the origins are the same. The origins are the idea that an emperor represents the power of the sun. And it spread east and west equally. Okay. I could go into more things like that. For example, why do you have a Mongol emperor sitting on the throne of Solomon with the Star of David on his chest? Well, because he'd learned just enough to know that Solomon was a hell of a guy who sat on a throne made of two lions, and he wanted all those symbols for himself. Even he's over in Mongolia. Now, where did he get all those ideas? Well, they were brought via Persianized Islamic ideas of the caliphate, which have borrowed on Jewish tradition that Muslims very well knew, transmuted through Asian and Persian ideas, and traveling eventually to the Mongol societies in Mongolia. So yeah, there's all this trade, and all this trade means is a trade in ideas, a trade in bigger pictures of the world. How do you explain that? Okay? Well, a lot of things happen. One is, we know within the history of Judaism that the Persian conquests of the Jewish people challenge the older ideas of the Jewish God that lives in a temple and move Judaism in a more and more reified monotheistic and spiritualized direction. At the same time, the Buddha appears in India at a time that the old Aryan answers to why we people are on top are no longer adequate. And the Buddha offers a much more refined metaphysical understanding of human life and its problems than can be offered by the Vedas or even the Upanishads. And it will take by that. I mean, Buddhism will almost conquer India quietly, but as a religious ideology, it almost conquers India before it moves to China, before you have the rise again of Brahminic religion, in which the Brahminic classes in India come up with a satisfactory answer to Buddhism that makes equal sense of the Indian experience. By that time, of course, Buddhism is on its way to China, where it's going to provide at least one more adequate answer to what the Chinese are experiencing at the end of the Han Dynasty than has been provided by classical Confucian and Taoist and primal religious beliefs. So this is happening. And in each case, religion does what religion has to do. It assures its followers that their understanding of their place in the world is uniquely realistic. That the way in which they think and understand and move in the world is properly oriented towards reality. Reality with a capital R. Okay? And by now, of course, in all of the cultures that I've mentioned, those claims have to be universal. Because if you're in Xi'an, you can't go make your religious claims without being conscious that you've got Muslim traders and Greek traders and the odd guy that's drifted all the way over from what would become Great Britain with his own ideas, right? And if you can't put your ideas out in front of his as embracing everything from Great Britain all the way to Xi'an, China, then you don't have credibility anymore, right? It's a big world, and you've got to act in this big world. So the axial age, in my view, has occurred over many times in many societies. And what happens in this axial age is that religious claims to be credible must be universal. They must claim to be universally true because people are now, at least at the upper echelons of society, dealing in the universe. They're dealing in a very big world of ideas and ideologies that all need to be fit together. Okay? But we need to go a step further than this as well. Because what happens in these new situations, in these new rising religions, isn't merely that humans are confronted with new levels of cultural pluralism and social pluralism and complexity. They begin to be confronted, and it would be interesting if I knew enough to find the exact place this happens in the history of thought. I think it's easy to trace. I just haven't done it. They begin to be confronted with the possibility that beyond what they know, there's even more of what they don't know. That out at the edge of the wild wood, which they can see, and which has come to them in the form of trade or conquest, there is that beyond the wild woods, the wide world, which they can't see, which they haven't met. But the mere expansion of their knowledge of different cultures suggests that beyond what they've just met coming in the city gate must be a guy they haven't met, who's still 100 miles out. Now imagine how your thinking differs then. When you're not merely thinking about, I now know a much bigger world than I've ever known, but I have the idea that the world to be known is bigger than the world I know. I have to explain both of those things. Not merely the world that I'm aware of, but the world I can imagine is out there that I'm not aware of. And I think that's where we see the emergence of the Axial Age religions, because one of their characteristics is they are not content to explain the world of experience. They want to explain the world that they can't experience but they can't imagine might be there. And that's a truly universal claim, right? I'm not only going to talk about immanence, what is known, I'm going to talk about transcendence. That which I don't know but I can imagine is there. And these great Axial Age religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, to name the big ones, the big six, okay, all take on this characteristic in the Axial Age. They not only make claims about what they know and what is known, they make claims about everything that could possibly be known. That they not only embrace the universe that they know, they embrace every possible universe. And so we have these enormous universal claims, claims about what is true for all humans, and claims about what is true about the transcendent framework within which every human now feels obliged to live, by the way. That's the other thing is, when you're a human, it's not enough to sort of be okay with the clan. You've met all these people outside the clan, you want to be okay with them. And then there's the imagined clans that you haven't met, and you want to be okay with them. And then there is transcendence, and you want to be okay with that too. That unimagined infinity beyond what I can see or know. Not every, by the way, but not every indication is that the average human being is quite okay with just knowing about me and my family and the next meal. Okay? But we have the rise of the great thinkers who are thinking well beyond that. Right? Who are thinking well beyond you live, you die, you feel pretty good, and you're gone. And so we have this enormous world of philosophy. Okay? However, let me add another problem, and it's a problem that comes up immediately. It's a problem that comes up when Buddhism arrives in China and bumps up against a rapidly forming Taoist philosophical system with which it doesn't agree with everything, right? And Confucianism. It happens when Buddhism confronts developing Brahmanism, or the Brahminic synthesis as it's often called, in which Buddhists and Brahmins have basically different understandings of reality. It's going to happen when Judaism meets its new younger brother, Christianity, with fundamentally different claims. And when they in turn meet Greek philosophy and Greek philosophical claims to be universal. In other words, what do you do when your universal claims aren't in agreement with somebody else's universal claims? When at some level they just don't work together. Now, I have an ongoing debate or discussion, or let's say a friendly discussion with a person I respect, Brahma Prana, I'm going to use her name in vain, who is the head of the Vedanta Society out in Irving. She's a Vedanta nun. And she and I have long conversations about this classic story, and you all know the story, of the blind men and the elephant, right? There's all these blind men and they feel a different part of the elephant, each one's different, but it's really the same elephant. Now the point I was making from the point is, that's a lovely story, right? But it assumes that if you're the teller of the story, you see the elephant and everyone else is blind. If you're as blind as everyone else, you don't know that it's an elephant, right? The minute you tell that story, what you've said is, I see it all, you each see it apart. Now, that's what every Axial Age religion was doing. I mean, it was willing to concede that everybody had some partial truth, but each one made its own claim, I see the elephant. The problem was that one says, I see the elephant, that you're all groping around. Another one says, I see the giraffe that you're all groping around. Another one says, I see the tiger that you're all groping around. Okay, you got a problem, right? It's a virtual menagerie of transcendencies. But the definition of transcendent is it's got to include everything, right? Okay, I hope you're with me on this. So it's not a matter of just theological disagreement. If I understand that the meaning of my life comes from my relationship with God or something else that is transcendent, and I come in contact with someone like a Buddhist who says that your word God or even the word transcendence is in fact just a word that is illusion, or if you're Chinese, kong, empty of all meaning, okay, well then how am I to find my life's meaning? How can there be two or more universal sources of meaning? Two or more ways of understanding human reality as a whole. Two or more religions, each claiming to be equally applicable to all human beings. That's a big problem. Now, each of these civilizations is going to resolve this problem in a slightly different way, depending on its own sense of itself and its religious mission. But I want to mention a few of them. Buddhism tended to say, especially in its Mahayana form, that every religion was a step towards knowing truth / transcendent reality as taught by the Buddha. It just happened that whatever sect of Mahayana Buddhism it was the top rung. Right? Everybody's on a step. It's just that eventually you're going to get to my step. One of the most interesting developments out of Mahayana Buddhism, by the way, in the modern world, is something called the Red Swastika Society, or sometimes called the Moral Uplift Society, that developed in Southeast Asia, where Buddhism came immediately into contact with Islam and Christianity, and immediately absorbed them by seeing Christianity, Islam, and Judaism as lower forms of Buddhism, leading ultimately to, of course, the Polar Sutra, and the transcendent truth of that particular version of Mahayana Buddhism. Okay? Hinduism. All religious consciousness is a legitimate path to Brahman. Brahman is the unnameable, undefinable essence of the whole universe. Every path leads to it. Taoism. Taoist philosophers sort of took the view that all religions were just a poor man's philosophy. So if you're truly philosophical, you didn't mess with religion. But if you didn't quite have the whatever it takes, mostly the leisure time, to indulge in philosophy, then you went to the temple. Okay. Christianity, typically, in its better forms, as opposed to its lesser better forms, in my view, has said, taken the verse from the Apostle Paul, Acts chapter 14, God has not left God's self without witnesses, in which you have the basic idea that God has somehow made God's self present in every religious tradition, every cultural tradition, but of course, that the revelation of Jesus Christ is the highest, most perfect, and fullest revelation. Islam has a similar kind of solution by saying that God has sent over 200,000 prophets, at least three, but probably many more books, so every people in all times and places have been seen the command of God, the will of God. But, of course, the Quran is the final and most complete revelation, and Muhammad is the final and most complete prophet. Each one finds a way to account for all the others, but it accounts for them generally by making them a slightly lesser form of the truth than it itself possesses. And that's a very logical thing. That's perfectly understandable. Okay. However, there's another possible solution. A solution that arises if you think about this problem philosophically. And that is to say, if I've attached the word transcendence, Brahman, the Tao, Nirvana, to that which is unknowable because it is so far beyond the human capacity to know, then maybe instead of asserting that I know it better than everyone else, I could just say that it's really a mystery. That my own unique insight to it, into it, is absolutely true. No need to back off on that. But to understand that anything that can be conceptualized by the human mind itself finite is by definition finite, and therefore cannot be a fully adequate representation of transcendent reality. simply by virtue of the fact that it's human. The mere claim that my knowledge was revealed to me out of transcendence, as it happens in some religions, is still not adequate to claim that I know everything about transcendence there is to know, because even if it's revealed, it's revealed to a mind that's definitely small. A mind that can't stretch to the extent of the God that it claims to worship. Okay? Indeed, in all of these religions, to some extent, in fact, really, in all of them in their most thoughtful extent and their most popular extent, the claim is going to always be, C.S. Lewis's words are useful here, that you should pray not to God as you know Him, but God as God knows God's self. Because you can never adequately know God, right? God will always be what you can contain in your finite brain. Okay? And so from this perspective, they're developed in all religious traditions, structures of belief and practice in which religion is a means of understanding mystery. And instead of containing mystery in one's own mind, in all of these religions, there's at least one set of practices that says, I will, in fact, instead of trying to know the transcendent, I will yield myself and surrender into transcendence. I will cease trying to know and merely ask that I be known. Or to put it another way, in all of these religious traditions, there is at least one tradition that says, the whole reality does not ask for your understanding, it asks for your surrender of understanding. That you simply name it mystery as it is. And religion and the great founders of religion are not, in this view, teachers of theology or resolvers of question about the universal. In this particular form of all these religions, the great teachers are guides in the quest toward mystery. Okay? Now, be warned, of course, that in every one of these religions, each of their founders is understood in two different ways. For many, perhaps the majority of the founders, these great founders of religion are seen as people who showed you the truth about the way things are and the way you ought to live. But in each religion, there is also another movement that says, no, the founder was a guide into a mystery that the founder could never actually teach to me as a limited person. Does that make sense? Now, the differences in these religious traditions would take some time to unpack, but the Christian tradition, which is my tradition, and I'm a Christian, is one of the easiest. Jesus is depicted as one who teaches, right? Who teaches about God, and specifically, and God's nature and God's aspects of God. But Jesus is also characterized as the pioneer, the one who goes ahead, the one whom one follows into a mystery that is unfathomably deep. I like, I'm going to close with something that comes out of a Christian tradition that I'm going to remind those of you who know or come from a Christian tradition of the last part of the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation has gotten a bad knock in Dallas in particular because it's been used as a source of sort of predicting the future, right? A kind of a joss sticks and divining blocks for the Christian. Tomorrow's news and today's newspaper, that kind of thing. I don't think that's a poor way to read Revelation, but it's especially useful if we go back and read Revelation chapter 20, chapter 21. I won't quote the whole thing for you, I'm just going to remind you, because it will lead into my next quote. In the end of that chapter, the person having the vision, John of Patmos, has a vision in which he sees the New Jerusalem. And the New Jerusalem is a city with 12 walls on 12 foundations. These symbolize both the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 disciples of Jesus Christ. And then he goes on to say that in this city, in each wall, there is a gate. And interestingly enough, the gates are open day and night. And a little Greek is useful here. And into the gates, continuous present tense, the kings of the earth bring their treasures continuously, without end. Continuously, without end. Now, what this should suggest, I think, to the Christian reader of Revelation is that in this vision of transcendence in which the gates are always open and there is always commerce with the rest of the world, that you don't close the gates. Okay? Now, what I tend to tell my Christian students is, many of them bent on closing the gates, that allows us to interpret Jesus' words to Peter where he says, I give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Right? What you bind on earth will be bound on earth. What you loose on earth will be loosed on earth. And my view of this is, of course, if you're a Christian, if you've been given the keys and God says the gates are always open, your job is to keep them open. Not to tell people that they'll be closed or to lock them. That's just my interpretation. Okay. I just think it's accurate. Okay. Now, but I want to end with a little C.S. Lewis here. This is The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. A pedestrian novel, but it ends so well. So you need to read the last part of it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm afraid I'll be touched by it. It's the story, if you know it, or no, you probably don't know it. You can catch it on HBO. I think someone's finally made movies of all of them. That's the way we absorb things in the modern world. Probably get it for your Kindle or your iPad. But it's about a voyage of a boat, and the central characters, in many ways, are these four children that appear in all the Narnia Chronicle novels, but they're grown up here. But in this case, they are accompanying a mouse or a rat. And this is a knight mouse. He's a knight. But he's a knight in the good old mystic sense of a knight. His quest is something like the quest for the Holy Grail. It's the quest to come into the kingdom of God. Okay? And so they get in this boat, and they sail as far east as they can sail, right? Into the rising sun. Okay? They sail into the rising sun with the mouse's intention to go as far as he can go. And as the book ends, the boat runs aground. And it runs aground in this mythical eastern place in front of a huge wave. And it's just a standing wave. It's just, the water that they're in is constantly pouring over some barrier into something. And they can't see beyond the mist. They can see sort of beyond the wave. There's a sun. The rising sun, obviously, is the symbol. And then they can't see what else there is. And they... And so the mouse now gets in a coracle. A coracle is a small boat, you know, the Irish kind of boat made with skins. And, of course, by the way, Lewis is brilliant on this, right? This is all intentional. He's thinking of the Celtic saints, the guys, St. Patrick and those guys who sailed out in the sea in their little boats. It's worth reading for someone who drank deep of a little myth. By the way, 3 o'clock SMU campus, Icelandic myths. I can't remember where the lecture is, but you might want to look it up online. Okay, I'll be there. I'll read from the place where it's, well, I'll just read a few sentences. The narrator says, in one split second they saw his shape, and then they saw it disappear over the wave, and no one can say that they have ever seen him again, but it's my belief that he came into Aslan's country and is alive there to this day. Aslan, of course, is Lewis's symbol for God, right? And then the sun raves, and they get out of their boat now, and they wade around. The water's so shallow, they get out of the ship, and they wade around. And then they begin to walk. And as they walk along this wave, they come to a land. And at the land, they come, of course, now this is Lewis reaching deeply into his Christian symbols. And he's reminding us of the end of the Gospel of John. They come to this land, and they find a lamb. And the lamb has made breakfast for them out of fish and invites them to eat. And they of themselves, of course, wish to go to Aslan's country, wish to go to God's land. And they say to the lamb, please land, lamb, is this the way to Aslan's country? And this is interesting. He says, not for you. For you, the door into Aslan's country is from your own world. Their own world. They're not from this Narnia, right? They're from Earth. What, said Edmund, is there a way into Aslan's country from our world too? And here's the answer, very interesting. There is a way into my country from every world, says Aslan, says the lamb. And there's the book ends. I want to pose you with a little problem, or at least an issue, a philosophical issue, something to think about. I'm not sure that these things are different, but it is worth reflecting on two different ideas. One is the idea that every path leads to the same place. The other is slightly different, but different idea, that to the place where everybody ought to go, there is at least one path from every place we start. Not every path is the right path, but there's always at least one path. If I wanted to talk for another 15, 16 hours, we could talk about which of those I think represents best the axial age religions. But I'm going to start there. Stop there with what I think is a profound truth. There is a way into my country from all the worlds, says the Lamb. Thank you very much. David, do you want to?
Yeah, I'll be moderate.
Okay. All right, questions?
Yes, Bob.
I remember a pastor, as an undergraduate, asking me a trip back in the 70s on world religions, and I was really impressed with Confucius, because as I recall, he more so than Muhammad or Buddha or Christ talked about how, you know, these are my perspectives on the meaning of life and religion, but if you go out into this world and find something that's better or strikes a deeper chord than what I say, abandon what I say and go with your heart, go with that other approach. And I just wanted to see if you could comment on that. Maybe my memory's unclear on that point.
I'm not sure that's exactly what Confucius is said to have said in his Analects. I think there's probably two things relevant here to Confucius' teaching. The first one is that among the Analects, one is certainly one in which he says, when I see a person who's doing bad, I take that as a reminder I shouldn't do the same thing. When I see a person doing better than I know how to do, then I follow his example. Right? And that may be the rough idea. But Confucius was also, or Confucius, was actually interesting in another way, because he was deeply agnostic about the existence of an invisible world. But he deeply believed in religion, and particularly in a sense of what we would call religious rituals, as a means of regulating human relationships both among humans and with the past, the remembered past and the potential future. So when his disciples ask him about gods and spirits, he says, I don't care about the gods and spirits, but I do care that you get the religious rituals right. And that might be worth looking up, because I've been reading an increasing number of things by people who characterize themselves, interestingly enough, as religious but not spiritual. We know very well people who are spiritual but not religious. But Confucius would easily have identified. He would have said, yes, I'm very religious. Religious is normally important. I'm just not spiritual. One of his disciples one time asked him, tell us about death. He said, you don't know how to live. How can I possibly talk to you about death? Learn how to live first. Let death take care of itself. It'll come. You'll learn soon enough. Right? Okay, other questions? I hope that's adequate. That's
good.
Yeah.
Yes, sir, back here in black.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Let me reserve that. Let me hear
the first thought, you know, the thought of the axial religions.
Mm-hmm.
My first thought was, the Library of Alexandria, mm-hmm. what might we have lost in the fire of the Library of Alexandria as it relates to the axial religions?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is, of course, a vast amount. Because, we don't even really have a catalog of the Library at Alexandria. What is almost certain is that we would know much more about Greek philosophical thought and its antecedents than we know now. I think what we know about the world beyond Greece is probably nothing new, in the sense that the Library of Alexandria probably had in it works or works about works that come from much further east, but we have access to those anyway, and the Pali Canon of Buddhism, in the Rig Veda, the Vedas, in the Upanishads, and the other Hindu books. What would be interesting to know, of course, is what was known in Alexandria. Even if we didn't have the books, if we had a catalog, we'd have an idea of what a melting point that was. And I think that's, from a historian's standpoint, that's what we're really missing, is we just wish knew who was there talking to each other. Probably, my guess is a substantial amount of Judaica as well, written Jewish works that are no longer available to us. That's my quick answer to that.
Okay, let's see.
Go with one more, yeah.
One of the other ones is, he spoke of the axial religions and how they spread out, how they're related, because of the empires with expand.
Sure, sure.
When empires expand, it's not mainly for economic reasons, but the main crust of the expansion is for economic progression. And if that's the case, if an empire's religion is going to expand and take over other territories, it's not the expansion of religion owing to economics.
Okay, yeah, I think I get where the question's coming from. That's a really good question. I guess I just want to do what professors always do, which is complexify it. It is certain that imperial conquest, and in fact all pre-imperial conquest, was driven to some extent by the desire for economic gain and an increase in wealth. And this was territorial conquest at a time when the fundamentals of wealth were always agrarian. Okay, there are different reasons, by the way. Eventually you're going to get to where the control of shipping and trade becomes more important than just conquering ground. Right. We may be in an era now where cultural conquest is more important. But the point is, yes, economy is part of it. But there's another important part of it as well that we shouldn't forget, and that is the need for the ruler to maintain prestige even among his own people. And prestige is gained by winning. Okay. So we have cultures that were prestige-oriented cultures in which, in a certain sense, you needed to go to war every year just to show that you could go to war. And that, of course, would depend on the individual culture. I think of the Egyptian pharaohs, for example, who, interestingly enough, did not engage in huge territorial conquests. For one thing, from an agrarian standpoint, the Nile River Valley was so much richer than everything within 800 miles of them that there wasn't, you going to conquer a bunch of desert? Okay, so the Egyptians, pharaohs, had another way of showing their prestige. Every so often they had to participate in this sort of huge thing where they proved they were God by running an obstacle course that took 2 days. I don't want to go into all that. But nonetheless, for many other cultures, prestige was enormously important, and this is why we find someone like Timur Ilang, the Mongol conqueror, being carried into war on a litter when he's desperately old and ill. Because he understands very well the first day he doesn't go to war with the Mongols, he's a dead man. That's all they respect. So I economics is important, but I don't think economics is ever the only value in a culture. And other values led to expansion as well. And one of them, in one form or another, was the concept of cultural prestige and personal prestige for the emperor. Yeah.
200 years from now, this could be Buddhist territory?
I'm thinking it's more likely some form of Pentecostal Roman Catholicism. That's just demographic speaking. I'm not...
Lawrence.
Yeah, Lawrence, sure.
Great talk, but I profoundly disagree with you. I think that, are you trying to say that because mankind cannot find truth, maybe in a capital letter, therefore we should surrender into a sort of mystery and what? And I think that is a reason. Then could you explain to me what you mean by truth?
Okay.
In this capital letter, like you said, a profound truth. So, like if anything, we cannot find what is out there.
Yeah.
Therefore, are we supposed to just surrender to mystery? And if it's true, that makes us going to be very lazy people, because you're not going to think anymore, because the Bible will give you different things to justify. that God is absolute truth. But if, for me, in per se, I don't really believe in any kind of absolute truth, how do I really relate with your discussion today?
Okay, well, I want to take this in two parts. One is, it's a very good question, and it's especially good because it is the question that is profoundly raised by the rise of modern science. And in fact, Richard Dawkins has a new book with somebody, I can't think of the name of it now, it's a book for adolescent readers, actually. Pretty disappointing in the level of argument, but he's writing for 14-year-olds. Anyway, but he makes this point exactly. And here's the way he draws it, and I think it's a useful way of drawing it, even though I disagree with him. He says that, if I'm understanding his argument correctly, I think I am, he's saying that as a committed scientist, he will not accept that there is any limit to the human ability to gain understanding. Not in a temporal framework. In other words, he knows that in his own lifetime he's not going to know everything there is to know. But he believes, almost as a point of morality, that you are morally obliged to not ever write anything off as mystery, because that'll make you quit looking. That you are morally obliged to say, we can know. We must keep trying to know. We must keep working at it. Steve Weinberg, in his great book, Dreams of a Final Theory, which is now 15 or 20 years old, makes essentially the same point. He says, we as scientists, and Weinberg, of course, one of the greatest physicists, cosmologists at the time, says we as scientists may not, in fact, know everything. And he's written a few articles on this. He says, in fact, he doubts that we will. But he says, again, he would say moral assertion that we must try to know, using the methods of science, using rational methods, and never surrendering to, in his view, religion or anything, that moral impetus, according to Weinberg, is what raises human life from the level of farce to tragedy. Okay? It's still a tragedy. It's not a farce. So that's Weinberg. Carl Sagan, his book, Science, a Light in a Demon-Haunted World, he pursues a very similar kind of thing. For these men, they're all men, I guess, for these men, the need to not assign truth, capital T truth, to mystery, capital M mystery, is a moral obligation that keeps them pressing forward to learn things by a method, a way of knowing, which they believe as an article of faith is the best way to know the universe as it is. Now, I'll say one more thing about that. If I accept that, and I believe they are right in their moral understanding on that. Okay. I think that what Weinberg comes closest to saying ought to be said as well, that the belief that the scientific method is the path to finding out what's true is itself an article of faith. It cannot be proven. Okay? There are no closed systems of truth, as Kurt Gödel very famously proved in his analysis of Bertrand Russell's Principia Mathematica. Okay? So, if you start with that's an article of faith, then I think that is a faith that is extremely commendable and which does an enormous amount for our world, and I take nothing away from it. Here, whatever.
I think this gentleman is in it first.
Yeah.
I think your answer, partially answered what I was going to ask is, I was going to say, outside of the realm of spirituality and religion, aren't there attempts to at universalism? You just mentioned three bishops of logical positivism, Sagan, Weinberg, and Dawkins. And, you know, when people say, oh, well, we can eventually explain your need for religion because what goes on in your brain, or we can explain it in terms of social science, or, you know, or Marxist dialectic, you know, there are all these ways of trying to sort of capture everything in religious and spiritual culture. Aren't those attempts at universalism, you know, more of the intellect?
Well, all of them are their own form of universal claim. I mean, they're a claim towards universal knowledge. In this case, they're a claim towards a system of knowledge that is theoretically universal in the same way that the religious system might be. I want to commend something, because you all are big readers, I can tell. So you get the online New York Times, and you go back to yesterday morning, I think. But maybe it was yesterday morning. In the editorial pages, there's an interesting discussion, Google it, neurophilosophy. Okay, it's an interesting discussion about neurophilosophy. Two guys take on two different sides of this, and it's precisely this. One side is saying, look, we will be able soon, maybe soon in relative terms, we will be able soon to explain at a chemical, molecular, and even atomic level everything that happens in your brain as you reason. Okay? And therefore, philosophy will come to an end. All that will be left is... No, because then what will be left is a description of the internal functioning of the brain. Now, I don't want to mischaracterize the answer to that from a person who teaches in... I mean, this guy's a philosopher, I suppose. Anyway, humanities. An article in Scientific American about this, too, as well. But the philosophical answer to that is, examine the structure of the arguments that you have made in your op-ed column, and you will see they are following the pattern of humanistic rationality, i.e., for you to make your arguments and verbalize them requires that you take a meta step above the chemical functioning of your brain and engage in the kind of discussions that philosophers do. You've gone beyond characterizing the own internal movement of atoms in a physical space to talking about ideas. And the fact that you can describe one doesn't make the other a less worthy way of describing reality, right? Even the scientist in describing the motions of the atoms has to depend on language. And what is language? You can reduce it, of course, to certain chemical movements and stuff like that, but then when you're using it to describe them, you've stepped above it. Those are fascinating, fascinating questions, which we do not have time for this evening. But I suggest that you all ask them. And by the way, again, I'm plugging SMU. My colleague, Billy Abraham, very smart guy who thinks about this like 170 times a day. So I don't ever mention it to him because he knows so much more than I do. Yeah.
Craig Miller. Relating to the question before last, it seems to be one of the few areas that theism and secular humanism agree on, and that is in theism, it seems to me, in the general sense of Christianity, the Bible, is that there's always room for infinite understanding that man can have if he's led by God, and especially when you go into the afterlife.
Sure.
And so I think that's we were created close enough with God to be worth fellowshipping with.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that worth fellowshipping with is the ability to comprehend, maybe always to a limited degree, but to comprehend a lot of stuff that we don't comprehend now.
Right. So we would share, to use religious terminology, we at least share in the divine mind. Our minds are at least partially sharing the divine mind.
Brian. Yes, I think you have to distinguish between different types of truth. Scientific truth is about the physical world and the history of the physical world and how things become more and more complex as time goes on and you find that life is developing and intelligent life is developing and so on. But religious truth, I think, is of a different sort. It's about what is the best way to live your life, especially interacting with other people, and finding ways that you can feel satisfied about your own place in the world and about, things which don't necessarily have a single answer, but depend very much on how the community decides to organize itself and how you can choose to find things that are fulfilling, especially I think most religions in terms of the Golden Rule would be saying that you can find a great deal of fulfillment out of considering the needs of other people and doing your best to serve them, which is rather more arbitrary and rather more of a mystery, and it's something that doesn't have any single solution at any particular time, because as time goes on, the community changes and the needs of the people change and so on. So I think that Carl Sagan and the other scientists you mentioned are talking about the truth that you can discover by finding the nature of reality, and I think there's no real barrier to that, except it's a lot of hard work and requires imagination to find the relationships. But religious truth, I think, is a different sort of truth.
Let me problematize that a little bit, okay? In the sense that I think where the real problem lies is, where a potential conflict lies would go back to Steven Weinberg's thing about science lifting you from farce to tragedy. And that is, in one form or another, a particular type of approach generally labeled scientific. But scientists don't agree on this, right? And that makes religious-like claims to being fully adequate to meeting all human needs, including the need to have meaning, ethics, morality, and etc. So it is the encompassing claim. It is the claim that not only says, as a scientist, I'm engaged in a particular type of quest, it's the further claim that says, and that quest is the only useful human quest. It's the only thing that humans ought to be involved in. The rest is nonsense. That's where you have tension, in a sense, with the substantial group of people who say, no, I'm all with you on that scientific quest. I just happen to think that this other thing is equally legitimate, useful, and helpful. Now,
the other type of tension that the scientists feel is that when religious authorities claim to make scientific statements about the real world, about the age of the universe,
everybody's got a lot at stake here. From a social standpoint, the rise of scientists as a social class is in direct competition with the authority of religious authorities as a social class. It's not very surprising that they come into conflict. Unfortunately, that social conflict between religious authorities and scientific authorities played out in many societies over many different ages, isn't quite the same as the philosophical problem of making all-encompassing claims to know the truth. And we don't have time tonight to deal with that, but that's I think, is a tough issue. We get another one. I think back here.
Yeah, so my question is this. At the heart of the knowable transcendent, the part of the transcendence that you call knowable, right?
Mm-hmm.
The portion that religions specifically claim that they have the knowledge of, when there's changes to that transcendent knowledge, so for example, that the Earth revolves around the sun, not
sure.
The other way, Galileo, mm-hmm. or social context too, right? Not just the physical world, but we should treat people the same, regardless of where they come from, or what their skin looks
right.
like, or what gender they are. When you have changes to that partial transcendent knowledge, I think what everyone's saying is, how do you reconcile that it makes it look like you're not accessing knowledge from a larger mystery, but rather inventing a mystery about which you access knowledge and change it as necessary?
Oh, such a good question. Yes, I mean, are we making God in our own constantly changing image? Or are we, okay, that's one possibility. Or are we accessing a body, God, a body of knowledge, which we have an incomplete knowledge of, but as we gain a more and more complete knowledge of, we can change. Now, just 2 points. One is historically, of course, this is part of the transition into the Axial Age religions. By claiming that limited knowledge is somehow related to a transcendent source, it becomes flexible and changeable, right? Because now you can always go back and say, well, I didn't, it, After all, I'm talking about transcendence. Yeah, I didn't get it first, right the first time. 200 years have passed. I've got biblical knowledge. But now I get it. Right. Now I get it. Okay. Right. But and each religion that I've talked about has some way of explaining its changing body of understanding of the world in relation to some kind of fixed understanding of transcendence. Each religion has its own way of explaining that. There is, of course, the opposing hypothesis, which is that people, for one reason or another, have always felt a need to ground the knowledge that they gain piecemeal and bit by grabbing the world, rationing about it, whatever methodology, to ground that in reality as a whole, okay, so that they sense that they have a sense of meaning in relation to reality as a whole and not just in relationship to themselves. Okay, here I want to psychologize a little bit. Okay, hey, that's an insoluble problem because it is a matter of faith and not of anything that can be proven, right? Whether we are, in fact, constantly creating God in our own transcendent image, or are, in fact, drawing on insights and intuitions that come to us from something bigger than us. Unfortunately, I don't believe that's either of those assertions is testable and provable. Okay, I think they are a matter of faith. I'm going to suggest to you that having dealt with theology students for like the last 24 years or 25 years, and all sorts of other people, that there's some degree of psychological capacity involved in this as well. There are people, maybe many of them when they're older rather than younger, there are people who are quite okay with not having the meaning of their life rooted in the transcendent meaning of the universe. Okay? And it's not merely that those people exist in our society today. They've existed historically. The Ebon people, the people, again, who I've spent some time studying, never ever believed that human life had eternal meaning. They assumed that humans came from somewhere, that you died, and that eventually your spirit disappeared into the universe as a whole, and your body disappeared into Mother Earth, or Pula Gunung, the porcupine god, and that everybody forgot you existed, and that you were just part of the wind and the rain and everything, and that was okay. They felt like it was adequate for human life to have meaning while you lived, within the context of their society and culture. It would be, it seems like, you know, David, this is a long time ago when we were reading science fiction. I can't remember whether it's Ray Bradbury or Robert Heinlein has a short story, and I tried to look it up, I couldn't find it, Grandmother, in which it's a sort of poetic reflection on how my stuff will be spread across the stars of the universe, et cetera, you know, I don't care. Okay. What I think is a more interesting question than this irresolvable one is why it is that at some turning point in human history, characterized as the Axial Age, a vastly larger number of human beings needed to see their life in terms of transcendent reality and have their meaning understood in those terms when they didn't before. What was the change of human consciousness? And it might be equally interesting to ask whether and why in our own time there seems to be a shift in human consciousness that at least for some substantial number of contemporary urban dwellers in modern societies no longer requires that. What a big, you know, that's a question. I don't have an answer. I wish I did. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I just had a question of, you know, when the rubber meets the road, it's the behavioral changes that religion brings about that are concrete.
Yeah.
Regardless of whatever life insurance in the sky we have, how that changes our behavior is what's important. And I look back to what I would consider an axial religion, the Songlines of Australia, which have been around for 50,000 years.
Yeah.
But when we first got religion was when we got dogs. The archaeological record.
Mm-hmm.
And because we got dogs, we had to alter our behavior.
Yeah.
And we had to hunt things with, that we can now hunt with dogs that we couldn't hunt before. Mm-hmm. And we had to learn about these things and pass that knowledge on to our children. And that's called totemic religion.
Sure.
And in a way, the God of grapes and wheat that you reference mm-hmm. is how you have to change your behavior to ensure that the grapes and wheat come up every year.
Mm-hmm. You had a good question.
So what I'm saying here is, as technology takes us to a more universal place, our behaviors are going to change above and beyond agrarian values of Christianity. We're all going to start living like people do in LA. And so what I'm saying is, do you see something going more towards what's in our DNA, or more towards what replaces the crops in the future?
Well, okay, there's a good question. I think it's the work of Thomas, what's his name? Thomas, the biologist that has written on bioethics. There has been some work done on the ethics rooted in DNA, right? I think the classic essay by Thomas, whose first name I can't remember, is... Lewis Thomas. Yeah, I would give my life for one brother, two cousins, or four second cousins, something like that. It's a perpetuation of DNA. I'm not sure that I agree with your characterization quite of the history of religion, but I understand the short form of it. I'll just make two comments on this. I think it's an open question whether the relationship between religion and ethics and morality, I think, remains an open question. This forum sponsored a debate about this about a year ago, and I think the one thing that the debaters agreed on was that you can be ethical without being religious. And we don't know the ins and outs of that. That is, however, I mention only because it's such an absolutely common misconception in our culture that ethics arises from religion, when in fact it's much more likely that religion justifies existing ethical systems, that I think it's worth contemplating.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
It's been my experience that religion justifies anti-ethical behavior.
Yes. There is anecdotal evidence on all sides of this issue. It depends on the religion. I mean, my personal religion, United Methodist Christianity, is pretty good at a congregational level, pretty bad at an Episcopal level. So I trust the members of my congregation, but not my mission. But I think that's an interesting and open question. If in the future the complexity of our social interactions begin to drive us towards a different ethic, I would say there seems to be evidence in that direction. And one reason for this is that we seem at a genetic level to understand that we need each other as humans. Okay? And that as our concept of humanity increases by increased interaction with different types of humans, the number of people who we can effectively call subhuman and therefore dismiss from our ethical concern becomes smaller. Okay? At the same time, an important countervailing force in this is that we cannot appear to keep a consistent self-identity with a group as large as the human race as a whole. We seem to need to be able to have a human identity that's smaller and that has an in and an out. And these two, the universalism of humanity and the need for an identity that is rooted in a smaller group, these seem to me to be at tension with each other, particularly in a globalized world. But I think there's a question way back here.
Next question, Dr. Alcant. We'll need to give him time to clean up the rest of this.
Yeah.
I'd like to get back to your original history.
Yeah.
And, what does it mean? Is it something that we can't explain or don't have an answer to, like a murder? Or is it a mystery because we don't have the answer now, but we will find it, like what causes a rainbow or human genome? Or is it a mystery that we can never know the answer to, like what came before the Big Bang? There are multiverses, there's life after death. If the mystery, like you said, is the transcendent or the supreme being or nirvana, and that is unknowable,
then it is unknowable if there is a person or a God. Then we can't, then we're agnostic about it. Then it is the ultimate mystery, whether there is a transcendent being or not. That's the mystery. But what do you mean by mystery?
Okay. Much more the last of your three definitions. Okay. And typically the word mystery, as it comes down in the Western tradition, in the philosophical and theological tradition, has designated that which is not only unknown, but is unknowable. Okay. And therefore, which is, in any realistic sense of the term, beyond all potential categorical distinctions of language. Right? So, and so in a certain sense, it's a word to designate the place where something is or might be or maybe isn't that we can't know. Let me go one step further though. Within human traditions, okay, there have been kind of two different approaches to this. And one of those approaches has been to say, with whatever light is available to my understanding, right, I will orient my life towards that transcendent mystery, okay, even though it's unknowable. And so, for example, the multiverse is a good example. Scientific American last month, there was a good article on why the multiverse can't be known. You probably saw it. By a scientist. But that doesn't mean he's giving up on cosmology, right? He's just saying, realistically, we shouldn't put out there ideas that our methods can never lead us to know. But he's not giving up on science, just because there's something he can't know. He said, you know, we keep plugging along towards what we can know. And the same would be a typically theistic solution, whether you're Hindu or Christian or Jewish. Transcendence with a capital T is in fact unknowable, but that doesn't mean you don't keep moving towards grasping it somehow in knowledge. I have to say, though, there is another alternative out there in the big religious world, and that's the alternative embraced by both Theravada in one way and Mahayana Buddhism in another way, which is to designate the concept of transcendence as empty, meaning it is of no human value to speak about it anymore or pursue it. Therefore, limit yourself to doing and pursuing that which is in the realm, at least the imaginable realm of the knowable, and that will make you happier, right? That will lead to whatever goal you have. I think if there was an easy resolution between these two different paths towards mystery, one of which says, it's not that it's not worth knowing, it's just, it's an empty concept, therefore forget it. And the other of which says, no, we need to just keep going toward it, whether it's through a scientific method or religious or meditation or whatever. I don't think that I can mediate between those two. They've been around for at least 2,000 years, probably longer. And my guess is that in some unknowable future time, when El Phoenix has morphed into a Pentecostal Roman Catholic restaurant, this group will still be meeting and asking that question. So thank you all very much.